Hello, heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. Heroes, I have a very exciting announcement for you. I will be at Gen Con 2016 in Indianapolis, Indiana. If any of you don't know, Gen Con is the largest tabletop gaming convention in North America. I will be in the Games on Demand area, helping greet and connect and organize games, and maybe GMing a session or two. You might also see me on a panel with my fellow One-Shot Network hosts, so stay tuned on that front. Today's guest is Shauna Germain of Monte Cook Games. You probably know her from her work on Numenera, the Cypher System, and the upcoming family-friendly RPG, No Thank You, Evil. I am also a huge fan of her erotic fiction and non-fiction about exploring the world of BDSM. That may seem unrelated to a show about role-playing games, but I believe that these two communities have a lot in common and a lot to learn from each other. So let's jump in. So Shauna Germain, creative director of Monte Cook Games. Before we get into anything else, can you tell me the story of how you came to be creative director at Monte Cook Games?
That's actually a very long story, so I can tell the short version.
You can tell the long version if you want.
A lot of it was luck, I think, and kind of knowing really amazing people. So I've been a writer and an editor for probably I feel like I've been saying 25 years for like 3 or 4 years now, so it's probably a few more than that. And I started in poetry and erotica, and then moved to sci-fi and fantasy, and then moved into writing nonfiction gaming stuff. My first nonfiction gaming job was for the World of Warcraft magazine. I was doing articles and stuff like that. And then I was talking with Monty, who had this idea for this game that he was really, really excited about. And he was like, you know, I'm really excited about this idea, but probably like 40 people are going to be interested in it, but I want to do it anyway. And as he was describing the setting, I was thinking, oh, that sounds like so much fun. I want to edit that. And so then we decided to go forward with that. And we had this Kickstarter that kind of just blew us out of the water and surprised us. And at that point, we realized that there was no way we were going to be able to do all the things that we wanted to do, just the two of us, and decided to start a company. And so at that point, I became co-owner and creative director. But at the time, because even at starting the company, there were only two of us, I was also one of the writers, the managing editor, and the art director. And so we have grown the company now to the point where I'm getting rid of a lot of these titles so that I can go back to doing what I love, which is actually creating stuff. So it's sort of been this it's like this character arc that's now in the middle of a denouement because I'm changing yet again, which is actually really exciting for me.
That's kind of an amazing story. I think of a lot of indie sort of stuff where I started out doing everything because yes. I had to do it all myself. And then you slowly get to like piece off the little bits that you like less to people who are even better at it.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the key. People who are better at it. You know, there's, I really loved, particularly I loved doing the art stuff, but I have no art skills and no art experience. And so I was like, I like the way this looks, let's go with it. And Monty also has a lot of art talent. And so we were able to kind of combine those, but having someone else who's just talented in that and able to do it is actually just really a pleasure.
Yeah. I mean, working with a team of people whose work that you love is like so much more satisfying than just saying like, well, I'm going to do this and hopefully it'll be sort of like what I want.
Yes, particularly when I not only love their work, I actually love the people that we work with. And I feel so lucky all the time when I hear horror stories about companies. And I don't know, I feel so lucky.
Aw, hooray. That's wonderful.
That's very Pollyanna, but it's very true.
And your story, I think, like pretty much everyone's story who works in the industry is completely unique. Like, there's no like, well, I went to game design university and then I graduated and got a job at the game design factory. Like,
I know, but you know, I just did help a class at DigiPen, which is like which is actually kind of a game design school. And I thought, wow, this is amazing that we've moved into this place where it's actually prominent enough and there are enough people that want to do this that they're actually making an accreditation for it. And I was thinking about how the future is going to be so different because people are going to say that. We're going to be like, what?
Well, I mean, for people right now who want to work in this industry doing whatever it is for role-playing games, either writing or in design or in art or whatever it is there advice that you give people who are looking for that kind of career?
I do. One is to really honor sort of what you do in yourself. And so like, don't work for free, don't give your stuff away, don't sort of grovel. But at the same time, be like super thankful for people who give you opportunities and be willing to start at the bottom. And so while those seem contradictory, it's kind of like a level of being willing to start you're in a place where, like, don't walk in and expect to be a fantastic designer, because there's so much to learn, and there are people who have been doing this so much longer than you that can teach you a ton. But at the same time, it's really important to value yourself and what you do. And I think that that's a very hard place to find that cross between humility and ego, and kind of stay there. And you have to stay there even when you sort of move into a higher place in the industry, because if you start getting a huge ego, that's really problematic. And if you don't have enough ego, the fans that are angry are just going to smush you.
Mm-hmm. How do you maintain that, like, level of ego, that, like, equanimity of ego?
For me, it's about doing the best work that I can, and really honoring the thing that I'm creating. And so when I'm working on something, or when I'm doing the work, I ask myself, is this the best I can do? And I aim for that. We have a philosophy at Monte Creek Games that is, you know, if you finish the thing, then go back and make it awesome, because that's really kind of what we want to do. And so we have actually time slotted in for people to finish a project and then take time, we call it make it awesome time, where you go back and you rethink what you're doing and you make sure that it's as good as you can do. And so for me, I try to protect myself in that sort of, this is the best that I can do, and I worked my hardest on it with the skill set that I have. And you hope that you always get better. But it's hard. I mean, it's a really complex place to be a creator and put your work out there, because people hate it, and they're going to. And so that's, you know, there's that whole idea that you hear something negative and it's 10 or 100 times louder than when you hear something positive. And so I think that having a good support group, having people who are in the same place as you, is really important, no matter what level you're at. Like, when you're a beginning writer or a beginning creator, you really need people who can buoy you and who can support you. And that's so important. And then at the same time, when you see people who are maybe above you, who have been doing it longer, to know that they are also struggling with ego and failure and all these things, I think is really important. And so I look to the people that I really love, the work that I really love. And when I read essays about them struggling with finishing things or feeling positive about it, I feel, okay, we're all in the same boat. This is part of the process. And that makes me feel better. And then sometimes just ice cream. You get a bad review and you're like, all right, Ben and Jerry's, here we go.
Only my good pals B and J will get me out of this one. You know, that last bit was so interesting. I read the most inspirational words on your blog the other day that were, every day I sit down to do my job and I don't know what I'm doing. I love that kind of so openness. True. And like, I mean, do you think it's important for yourself? Is it important for, like, are you thinking about other people getting into the industry when you, you know, have that kind of openness?
Yeah, I think, you know, I taught writing for a really long time and I really loved it. And the only reason I don't do it anymore is just lack of time. But I think when I was first starting, the people who sort of reached down and helped me were people who were really successful, but who said, like, look, on the inside, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And, oh, sorry, can I swear?
Oh, fuck yeah.
Sorry, okay. I usually ask. The way they helped me the most was saying, look, we don't know what we're doing. We still do it, and that's okay. And so I want to give that back. I want young creators or new creators or even people who have done it for a long time who are just floundering to know that we are all in that same space. I think that's really important. And it's also important for me to be okay with not knowing. I saw this really, really great live radio show in Seattle not that long ago, and they were talking about sort of entering the forest of unknowing. And I thought that was so brilliant, because for so much of my life, I spent time sort of running from that place because it's dark and it's scary and you don't know your way. And in order for me to be a good creator, I have to be willing to walk into that place. I have to be willing to say, look, I don't know. Something could leap out of the trees and kill me, and that has to be kind of okay. So I think part of my philosophy is not being fearless, because that implies that you don't have fear, but stepping forward even anyway. And that's really hard. I think that kills so many creators. Mm-hmm. There's this pressure.
Yeah. So your upcoming novel, Poison Eater, which is set in the Numenera universe, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You've been blogging about it a lot. I'm wondering, is that just like a Kickstarter I said I would thing? Or is this like, has it been helping you? Has it been helping the process, hindering the process, a distraction?
Yes, all of those things. Actually, that's really so I have done this before. I used to do NaNoWriMo. My first couple of published novels started as NaNoWriMo novels. And one year, the one that I did was if you donated a certain amount to a GLBTQ charity, you were able to watch the process. And so you got to read the draft as I was writing it. And so it was like a passworded blog. And so, you know, I think we raised like more than $1,000 of people who wanted to come in, and like, and so they were reading it and I was talking about my process. And some of them were writers who wanted to sort of watch a novel be born. And some of them were readers of mine who kind of wanted to, sort of a first glimpse behind that. And I haven't done that since. It's kind of time consuming. And we didn't promise it in the Kickstarter, but I thought that it would be interesting to have people watch it sort of come to life and see what it was. And also it's an opportunity for me in a weird way, because I don't teach anymore. It's an opportunity for me to offer inspiration and guidance to writers if they want it. And it's also, I love writing, and I love learning about writing, and I love that process. And so, you know, getting to write about the behind the scenes, like this is how I developed the language that they use in this novel, is really, it excites me to be able to talk about that backstory stuff, which isn't something that most people see in the novel, because you've hidden that. It's like behind the curtains. But I love that stuff. I love that. I don't even know what that is. It's like magpie, where I collect the collection of all the things that you have in this little basket. And I like to show that. I think that people find that interesting.
It's like a way to keep teaching in this, you know, slightly indirect, like sort of teach by example thing.
Yeah. And teach by inspiration. I feel like my whole message as a teacher was to help people find their way and help them keep moving forward. So many of the great writers that I taught, I mean, I taught students who were way better writers than I was. And the problem was that they just were so afraid. And so I feel like my whole life teaching has been about helping people not be so afraid or stepping through that fear.
I think that's true of a lot of teachers. I took adult swimming lessons.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And I was someone who kind of could swim but wanted to learn to do it better. But there were tons and tons of people there who are way more athletic and like way more coordinated, but just... there's just like a lack of familiarity, or maybe they had a bad experience or whatever. And so like for some people, just getting their face underwater was like the biggest accomplishment, you know, for the whole class.
Wow, that's amazing. I hadn't even thought of something like that.
So we've obliquely referred to Numenera many times. I'm sure most people listening to this know it was this hugely, hugely successful Kickstarter. And now it's a super cool game that is everywhere and lots of people love. In terms of the, you know, as you said, very unexpected success of Numenera as this very out of nowhere appearance, it sounds like some wonderful things have come out of that. Has there been any kind of negative aspect in terms of being a suddenly very visible woman on the internet?
It's very interesting for me, because when I worked in erotica, I was a very visible woman on the internet in a totally different genre. And that was a very interesting space, because like I got a lot, it was sort of almost pre-email. And so I was still getting people who sent letters telling me that I was going to hell for writing about sex. And so that I kind of, you know, you sort of get a taste of what that's like. So I got that early on. And so the internet continues to be a place that's difficult, I think, for lots of people. I mean, it's changing our society in really interesting and often very detrimental ways, even though it brings us great things. So I think that in a lot of ways I was prepared for that. Most of the time, thankfully, I don't have very many bad experiences. Most of my experiences have been super positive. We have a super supportive community. And so I think that there's something about my philosophy, even when I wrote erotica, was that I was just going to be really open. I was going to use my own name. I was going to talk about it. Because I feel like if I don't have any dirt to dig up, then I'm pretty safe. You know, I feel like if I am very open and don't have any secrets, and I'm just sort of fierce, that gives me a lot of protection. And my goal is always to protect for those who don't have protection, because I'm very aware that I'm very lucky, right? I don't have kids. So that, you know, even when I was writing about sex, like I never had to worry that was going to be a negative repercussion for them. You know, my family is really open. They know what I do for a living. So I feel like in many ways I can help people who don't have that kind of protection. And I'm just sort of not afraid, which is probably pretty stupid. But, you know, I've lived all over the world and I traveled all over the world, and I've always worked in male-dominated industries. And I just feel like I can't live my life worrying about that. I have to just do the best that I can do, and occasionally have some ice cream and cry, and then just move on and do something else.
Is there even just like pressure from having, at the time, you know, the highest funded RPG on Kickstarter?
I think there was. I think most of the pressure was internal. Like, we put a lot of pressure on ourselves to be great and to really honor that. Because, and there's a lot of reasons for that. One is we wanted to be able to go forth and do it again. And the other is that we wanted other game companies to be able to go forth and do it again. Like, if we failed to deliver, or if we've delivered bad products, or if we were super late, that has a negative impact on the whole industry. There's the chance that in the future, people wouldn't back Kickstarters because we were the most public and the most funded, and then they wouldn't trust it. And so there was a lot of responsibility. I felt a lot of responsibility to honor the commitment that we made for ourselves, but also for everyone who kind of wanted to follow and do other things. And of course, if we had looked into the future, we would have known that we were going to do a whole bunch of Kickstarters. And so that was also beneficial. But at the time, we didn't know that. So it was really about honoring our fans and the people who backed us, and then trying to help buoy the industry as a whole and you know, make people trust Kickstarter, because Kickstarter at the time was kind of new and people were uncertain. And, you know, as we've seen, some have fallen since then. Some products haven't delivered, or I have some products that are very, very late that I don't think I'm ever going to get. And, you know, I think that, I don't know, that's a very important thing for me to honor as best as we can, the people who put trust in us, because they didn't know us. I mean, they knew Monty, but the game was new. Kickstarter was new. I mean, there were so many risks that they were taking. And I kind of feel that way about everything I write. You are taking a risk. You're spending your time. You're spending your money. I need to honor that and make it as good of an experience as I can.
Oh, that's beautiful. Something you've been working on more recently, No Thank You Evil, is it kind of, without labeling itself as such, sort of a childified version of Numenera's Cypher system, right?
That is totally right. We labeled it a family game, and it is really very much a simplified, kind of modified version of the Cypher system. We took out numbers over 9, because we know that kids have a hard time with double digits, and we brought things to a very, very simple space where it's all about imagination and saying yes. And it was actually really, really fun to work on. I typically am a very dark, kind of scary horror sci-fi writer. And so, you know, sort of like writing with lots of puns and these very silly monsters and these very silly abilities was really actually very fun.
So in terms of design goals, are you deliberately trying to like foster the next generation of gamers?
Oh, yes. For sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I was just telling someone else this story. My first RPG was Bunnies and Burrows.
Wonderful.
And it was all because I got to be a bunny and I got to run around and stamp my feet on the floor. And, you know, I'm sure that my babysitter who introduced me to that was very sad that she introduced me, because I was very hyper. But I think about the joy that reading and games brought me when I was a child. So I was very shy. I was very introverted. I say was, but, you know, still I am. I'm very socially awkward, all of these things. And so games gave me a role to play in groups. They allowed me to use my imagination. They allowed me to be rewarded for the things that I was good at, which was making stuff up and kind of being sort of playful in a place that wasn't my own. And so I want that for people. I want that for kids. I want that for families, because so many families now are playing games with their kids. And that wasn't true in my generation. I mean, you know, my families were hippies, but they weren't, you know, they didn't play D&D with me. They didn't play role-playing games. We played a lot of Skip-Bo and Monopoly. And so, yeah, absolutely. I mean, how amazing would that be to hear stories in 20 years from kids who played with their parents? I think that's just awesome.
And I think a lot of people who are in this hobby, they want something, and they're either like house ruling something or simplifying something or making something up because they really want to play with their kids, probably because they see how imaginative their kids are and they're like, I want some of that.
So true. Well, we actually came up with the idea of a family game because so many people are house ruling Numenera. And it wasn't that they were house ruling the rules. It was that they were house ruling the setting because of the sort of, you know, Numenera is really dark. And we were like, oh, you know, so they were putting like Disney in Numenera, which is awesome. But I was like, wow, I would never have thought to play that with kids because it's so, so very dark. But it was really, I think, the system that drew them in. And because we didn't have any other settings out, they were just sort of modifying, you know, those things. And so when we saw that, we saw so many families wanting to play with their kids and young kids, like 5 years old and 4 years old, and raising them at the table. That was sort of the impetus for going, oh, you know, there are families out there who want this thing. We could help them rather than having them house rule all these things and really give them the groundwork to build from.
You know, I like that idea of breaking down like kids' games and the adult games, and just being like, what are games that families can play all together?
Yeah,
Yeah. In a blog post about the process, you mentioned that young players will be incredibly creative, incredibly smart, and very easily distracted. I have to ask, what was it like playtesting with kids?
First of all, it was very ego busting because I was like, I do this creative thing for a living. I'm very creative. And then you spend an hour with these kids at the table and you're like, oh my God, I've never created anything this imaginative in my whole life. In a really good way, it was very hard on the ego because it's just like, wow, you just thought of that? That's amazing. On the other hand, it's so the playtest that we did, we specifically were playtesting with kids who had never played before, kids who are on the autism spectrum, and kids with dyslexia, because we really wanted to make sure that the rules worked for as many people as we could, as many families and kids as we could. And so we would you know, particularly at there's a game store called Uncle's Games that allowed us to come in and play test there. And that was really great because it was this sort of very distractible, lots of stuff going on, kind of interactive place. And so you get six kids at the table and two are on the autism spectrum. And if you struggle with dyslexia, and then if you have, you know, other things, or their parents are dyslexic, or their parents are on the autism spectrum. And so there was this sort of way in which we watched these kids figure out how to work together around the things that kept them apart normally. And so it was really amazing. Like, we have one role where everybody rolls so that you can work together. And part of the reason that we created that was because we saw the kids going, I want to know how to help. I want to help you. I don't want to see you get hurt. Like, you know, and there was this really there was a strong desire to work together. And I realized that the mechanics needed to provide a way to do that so that the parents didn't have to house rule that. And so on one hand, it was sort of this chaotic, crazy experience, but it was controlled chaos in a way that the kids clearly really had a good time and were, I think, like, one of the parents, I think, was very surprised to see. So his son had been taking improv classes to help with being on the autism spectrum, to help with his communication skills. And his dad came to me after and said that, like, he had never seen his son use those improv skills until the moment that he was in the game. And so here suddenly he had these skills that he had been working on in like a classroom setting, like, brought kind of into the real world. I mean, you know, and he thought that he was so glad to see that. And it was something that I wouldn't have known, right? I just thought, oh gosh, he's doing a really good job of communicating. And so it was really fascinating to see the different ways, and it really guided how we made the rules. We wanted them to be open. We wanted to reward creativity and to reward players for doing anything they wanted. So, like, if they struggle with verbal skills, we wanted them to be able to write or draw or act out. Whereas if they're shy and they're better at noises than anything else, we wanted to reward that. And so it allowed us to really see the spectrum of kind of kids' abilities and skills. But definitely after a couple of hours, I was like, okay, I need a break. I need to go read a book somewhere. That's amazing. They're so creative. Oh my gosh.
There's kind of an aspect, you know, thank you, evil, that is like modular or like scalable as well, right?
Right. Yeah. It really wasn't like, you know, designing for an adult is sort of like you can design a game set for, you know, 20 on up, and it's kind of the same. But the scalable idea actually came because we realized that we wanted it to be a family game, and most families don't have five kids who are five. They have a 5-year-old, an 8-year-old, an 11-year-old. And so we wanted to make sure that those three kids could play together. And in order to do that, it had to be a way that everyone could be successful and that everyone could feel like they were able to either step up or to help those who were sort of starting more basically. And so there's a 3-tier system. And it's basically, again, the simplified cipher system. And so the first one is just, I'm a princess. And so that's all you have. And it's very simple. And what we found was that the 5-year-old wants to play what the 11-year-old is playing. And so the 11-year-old helps the 5-year-old get to that third level. And so there's this really cool interaction that happens in a way that I think could have been more antagonistic or sort of, you know, sibling rivalry before. Now it becomes a place where the older siblings can really help the younger siblings kind of step up. And that was really our goal, was to make something that parents didn't have to try and kind of fit into each of their kids' levels, and that would actually work. But it also works, you know, if you're for Girl Scout groups or Boy Scout groups, if you have a group of 5 players who are all 10, you can just use the same system. You can use the same character level for all of them, and it works just like that.
Interesting. What were your sort of design influences in terms of designing for children? Because there's not a ton of RPGs made for that age group, but there are, you know, there's a whole field of children's books and like children's board games. Were you looking at any of that?
We did. We now have a large collection of kids' board games, despite not having kids. So we bought a ton of board games and really broke them apart. Not on a mechanic sense, but on a tactile sense. What do the pieces look like? What is the right size for small hands? What's appealing in terms of art and colors? How do you know? Can you get things in and out of the box? So we're kind of breaking apart the really tactile elements of the board games, and then I read as many kids' RPGs as I could find. So I read Hero Kids, and I read there's a really great one about fairies, and then there's a bunch of like Adventure Maximus. And so I was reading all of these games and all of these rule sets to see what was already out there, because we didn't want to duplicate and we didn't want to compete. We wanted to fill a hole. And so what we found was this hole that was really about, like I said, playing with families as opposed to playing with a bunch of kids that were the same age. And so I did a lot of research into that. And then I am a huge like fairy tale kids book kind of fan. And so I went back and kind of reread all of my old favorites and looked at what was new, and I looked at what was popular, like with kids' friends and kind of other things, and spent a lot of time particularly looking at art. We didn't want to go that art route where it looks like what adults think kids like, which is a very sort of common art route. We really wanted to know what kids liked. And so when we started out doing art, we asked the kids, we gauged their reaction. You know, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? And so we were able to really get things that appealed and drew them in ways that it was really exciting. So that was really an important part of it for us.
Yeah, that's cool. And getting that feedback from kids is so important too, right? Or else you're just imposing your idea of what kids should like or probably like or whatever. And kids are great at feedback because they are so like, they will not hesitate if they do not like it.
So true.
To spin things on a just complete, I don't know, 180 degree turn, another book that I read while researching for this interview was Kinky As You Want to Be, which was such a great read.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
So I know for sure that there is a huge overlap between kinky folks and gaming folks. Like that cannot be a yes. secret to anyone. But in reading this, I see that there's also just a lot of parallels in terms of how those communities and operate.
I think so too. I wrote an article a long time ago about that overlap. And I think it's really fascinating because they have really similar benefits, and they have really similar problems, and they operate in really similar ways. And there is, like you say, a lot of crossover. And, you know, it's interesting watching gaming kind of come out of the shadows, because I think that at some point the kink community will have that same sort of process, but it hasn't quite happened yet. And in fact, I think that the sort of popularity of things like 50 Shades of Grey has actually pushed kink back into the shadows a little bit. So it's kind of interesting. As the gaming community, the geeky community comes forth, I wonder whether the kinky community will kind of follow and come out. But it's hard to know. It's hard to sort of see that stuff going forward. But I love how much crossover there. And I love that the crossover is everything from sort of this philosophy about how we talk about, you know, consent at the table and consent in the bedroom. And then there's like just the language. I mean, that they both have dungeons. They both, you know, and it's just, there are all these sort of wonderful levels.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and also I feel like people's biggest concern or their sort of first big question that they have is, how do I access this community? And that's a huge problem for kinky people and for people who want to play role-playing games.
I think so too. And particularly, of course, we're finding that the sort of the people who are on the outskirts of that, right? So like, you know, in both cases, it's easier for people who are kind of already in the know to be part of those things. But people who are in really rural areas or super conservative communities, right, that it's a much harder space to enter. They don't have the resources. They don't know where to begin. And it you would think that the internet would have fixed that problem. And in fact, I don't think that it has. And maybe it's made it a little worse, because it's like, I don't know, I have 20 doors now and all of them are not certain.
I think it can be overwhelming for people, especially when you're looking for kink stuff, because you're like, what of this do I like? What do I have to like all of it? Is it okay right. if I just like this part? Where do I? And, you know, and ultimately, just as, you know, I'm of the opinion that playing over Hangouts or over Skype is just not the same as playing in person, kink stuff is the same. You know, you can watch and read and imagine all you like, but it's not the same as like actually finding other physically tangible, like their people, right? Both gaming and kink have this thing with public events that you can go to that are somewhat easy to find, maybe if you know where to look. But then like the movement from those events to private events is also like a tough one for people to make.
Right. Because I think that another thing that's very similar in the communities is a sense of like a large percentage of people who are shy or introverted or socially uncertain, right? Or have social anxiety. Like, and I know that for me, like the thought of stepping into any kind of party, whether it's geeky or kinky, where I don't know anyone, is just overwhelming. I'm like, no, thank you. I mean, I'm a super shy introverted, and so those like parties are just not, I'm like, what? Oh, okay, somebody talk to me, please. Okay, oh, look, it's a dog. I'm so happy right now. I think that when you couple the difficulty of finding entry with the fact that so many of us feel uncertain about these things, I think it makes it even harder. Like you really need, I should only speak for myself, I really need someone to take me by the hand and say, okay, this is the thing that's good and safe and fun, and come along and I will help you, right? I was just thinking about how great it would be if we could all have mentors in the thing that's difficult in our lives. Mm-hmm. Someone who just took us by the hand and was like, here, I will help you through this first process. You know, it's going to be fine, because there's so many things that we all want to do and we're so afraid, or we don't know how, or there are all these hurdles in front of them. Mm-hmm. And like if somebody could just reach out and be like, okay, we've got this. This is good. I mean, how amazing would that be? We just don't have a system for that.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough enough in like a RPG and LARP sense, because I think so many people think that LARP is really cool and they want to do it. But the idea of just like showing up, like, hi, I don't know anyone here. What you doing, guys? Like, I think that's so terrifying for people, is where like if you have some friends who are into it or someone who's into it, and just like gaming and kink to an even greater extent, I think it's really, really hard for people to even ask someone else to come with you to right. something, right?
Right. That's very vulnerable. We spend so much of our lives vulnerable. And I think that if we just had help through that, I think that we would all, I don't know, I have a lot of theories about, like, you know, things like anger and why that comes from feeling vulnerable. And if someone could just mm-hmm. help us through those vulnerability spaces, like how much more giving could we be? How much better people could we be? How much more fulfilled would we be? And then able to turn around and give that to someone else.
Yeah, that's a wonderful idea.
I have big lofty goals.
But I think people are doing things like this. I know at some conventions, Avi from the Double Exposure has a sort of like kind of mentorship thing setting up, especially for new designers. But yeah, I think anyone like engaging with the community at all kind of needs support. And it is a scary and is a vulnerable kind of step to take for kinky or geeky stuff. The biggest thing that jumped out to me when I was reading it, to be honest, was, why, like, it's such a great introduction. Why is there no introduction like this to gaming communities? As nerdy as you want
to
be.
I have to try to write that. As nerdy as you want to be. That's brilliant. Oh my God.
If you were writing something like that, what would you put in it? What would be the, like, give me the table of contents.
Okay. So I would say, that's really interesting, because I think it would be really similar. I think it would be about whatever you love is okay. Whatever everyone else loves is okay. Like, you don't have to spend time disagreeing about what you love. Just love what you love and let the other people love what you love, right? I mean, that's a very big part of the kinky element too. But I would also say, like, learn what you love, right? Watch the things, try the things, read the things, test the things, play the games. Be open to new experiences and to finding out what you adore. Because there are things that, well, first of all, for me, like, I talk in the book about how my tastes changed on the sort of kinky level. And that's true for me as a geeky person, too. Like, there's a time when I really loved Rules Heavy Game. And now I've sort of moved away from that. And I'll probably move back. And there was a time when I loved MMOs. And now I'm much more into, you know, Fallout or Don't Starve or things where I sort of spend time quietly engaging within a world and a character. And so I think, you know, don't feel like, oh, I know everything that I love and I'm never going to love anything else. Like, be open to changing and growing. And I think, too, that find the space that supports and buoys and welcomes you. I think we spend a lot of time in places that are not good for us or with people that are not good for us. There's a lot of aggression and anger and ire. And on one hand, that changes the world and it's really, it can be beneficial. But on the other hand, like, take care of yourself first, right? Make sure that you have all the shields that you need. Make sure that you have all the support that you need. Make sure that you're feeling very, very strong before you go forth and try to change the world, because we need you to keep changing the world forever, right? We need you to keep finding safe spaces for yourself. And so it's like people charge forth and then get really hurt. And this is true in all those communities. And they didn't take the time or didn't have the knowledge to build up their armor and just kind of figure out what was right for them. And then also communication. I think everything I ever talk about comes back to communication. Say what you expect. You know, in this gaming group, what I expect is the following. Agree, and then keep your agreements. Like if you say, if your GM is like, I expect this, this, and this, and you're like, okay, don't go back on that, right? Or talk about the fact that you fell down on that. Or I think communication in an open, honest, non-aggressive, non-sort of blaming way is really the way that we all make progress and we all move together and solidify kind of our community. And so I think it's really easy to communicate but not actually communicate. It's a skill. Nobody teaches us how to talk. And so for me, I think that learning how to communicate clearly, effectively, kindly, I think those are really, really important.
You wrote a supplement for Numenera called Love and Sex in the Ninth World, which I would encourage anyone who's interested in like sex and intimate relationships in RPGs to just go and check out whether or not you play Numenera. Because there's a lot of very like practical, relatively system neutral advice in just here's how you as a GM or as a player can talk about this kind of stuff with your group. I guess, I mean, my question is like, how excited were you to write a supplement like that?
So excited. I can't even tell you. I mean, it was, I think I had been on a couple panels where people had started asking questions about that. Cause it's sort of an interesting thing. Like as soon as people discover that you write and talk and are willing to talk about sex, like suddenly you realize how deeply and how badly people need a safe space to talk about it. And so I was on a couple panels and people were asking about sex at the table or playing romance or playing sexuality. And I started thinking, and I sort of offhandedly, this is how everything happens at Monte Cook Games. I was like, offhandedly, you know, we should write a supplement for that. And then next thing we know, we're like, yeah, all right, it's on the schedule. And so I was really excited because I have long felt that while there have been things written about sex, they have not necessarily done it justice. They've kind of taken it from that very tee-hee or sort of sordid element. And really for me, like, I feel like sex is just like anything else, right? If you love cooking food, you're going to talk about cooking food in a way that is not sort of tee-hee or not sort of like you're 12, or you're going to talk about great recipes and whatever. And so like, I feel that way about combat, right? We talk about combat like it's an everyday ordinary thing to pull out your sword and wield your sword and kill a thing. And that's just kind of what you do. And I feel that way about sex too, right? Like the people who love sex, they just talk about sex like it's a normal thing and you go with your partner and you do this thing. And so what I really wanted to present overall was just this sense that, like, in fact, despite the fact that there's a supplement that's separate about it, it actually is just kind of a normal part of life and it should be treated like every other game element if you want to add it to your game, right? I was very clear to say, like, that you shouldn't feel pressured to put sex in your game. I mean, just like you shouldn't feel pressured to put war or killing or combat or any of those things, right? Your game is your game. But I really wanted people to have someone say to them, it's okay to talk about this like it's a normal, you know, common thing that doesn't need to sort of be, it doesn't need to be cliched, because that also happens. It doesn't need to be cliched. It doesn't need to be sort of this joke, but it could be. I mean, you can, you know, sex is funny. Oh my God, the things that happen between people during sexuality is just, it's fun, yeah. Hysterical, right? I mean, and so, you know, so making it funny isn't a bad thing, but to know that there are other options, to know that you can treat it as a great emotional space. I mean, we watch movies that have sex in them all the time as an emotional crux or an emotional point. And we read books and it just, we know that in our real lives, sex is important. It matters. It changes us as a character. So why not have that true of games as well? Sorry, I got on my soapbox there a little bit.
Nope, that's exactly what I want my podcast guests. Get on the box. There's also some great setting stuff in that. What I was most impressed by is there's a huge variety of sex work in that, not just in like sex workers exist, but here's how they exist in this totally different culture that's totally different from our own. And I love that idea of using fantasy to go actually beyond representation, not just that there's gay folks, there's trans folks, there's whatever, but also here are some aspects of sexuality that exist only in this fantasy land. And it's like on anything you've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, that's the great thing I think about writing in fantasy that I think a lot of people don't actually take advantage of, which is that in particular, like Numenera doesn't have any of the Christian or religious or even pagan tropes that we know as a culture. And so the essence of sexuality isn't tinged with any of that history that we have. And so I could just start from scratch and talk about, like, you know, and I was thinking, all right, so if I take out all of the history and all of the religion and all of the sort of processes that we've done in the political space that we're in now, and you just start as a human culture from the very, very beginning, like, what are the possibilities? That's one of the things that's really important to me writing fantasy or sci-fi anyway, is not basing it on what we know and pushing it forward, but sort of starting from this base where anything's possible, because it's so fun to just be like, and then they just do this, because why not? You know, the human imagination about things like sex is just so broad and so varied. And when you start talking to people about what they do, you're just like, oh, wow, I never even thought of that. And so why not have a culture where that is true? So it's actually really fun to not have any constraints and to just be able to sort of raise the whole thing and start from scratch.
Yeah, and to pepper that in, and in doing so, say, and maybe there's some other tiny little enclave where people are doing something completely different. Can you think of that? A lot of this stuff is, in the supplement, is phrased as, here's a great hook for your story.
What I wanted to, you know, and part of the reason that we included sex work was because I think it's difficult, for, like we were talking about before, stepping into geeky or gaming communities, I think it's difficult for people to step into sex at the table, which is why we get cliches, you know, the, you know, prostitute that you take home from the bar, the guard that you seduce, the sort of very sort of straight and narrow. And it's because that's the only door that people know. And so by including things like sex work in that, there is a way to enter this sort of unique sexual space with a sort of money exchange, with a bartering, with a system. And I think that having a very, very rules light kind of game mechanic that's built into the world like that really helps people step through that door. Because otherwise it's like, oh, this sounds really cool, but I don't actually know how to implement it, or I don't know how to get my players involved. And so we wanted to ask people to think. So I was like, if you go to the garden, she's a pregnant woman whose husband has just left her. Like, what? How is that different? And what does that have to do with sex? And like, because all of those things are sexual, and it takes you beyond the cliche into thinking of them as real people that have real issues. And I think that's really important at the table.
Yeah, totally. And I like your approach to misogyny and homophobia in Numenera, which is just like a two sentence, like, yeah, they don't really have that. It's great.
It's a culture that's not built on our culture. And so, you know, they do have things like they have slaves. They have a class system, right? Because I do think that humans, even humans a million years in the future, do tend to sort of divide things, right? Somebody has to be higher, somebody has to be lower. There has to be some kind of bartering system. And so, you know, to say that it was a utopia would have been unrealistic, even for a billion years in the future, because humans, they just don't think like that, right? It's just not possible. And so I wanted to make it really clear that, yes, there are these classes and there's this hierarchy, but it isn't based on gender. It's not based on the things that we think of it being based on. And I think that's kind of hopefully sort of the next step, right? Because when I was first sort of learning about feminism and reading about feminism, there were a lot of really great books that were sort of, here's the female-led culture. Here's the majority, the culture that's only women. And those are really a great next step into sort of helping me understand how the world worked and how gender worked. But I feel like for me, personally, the next step is to make that something entirely new, to look mm-hmm. at gender as a spectrum, and to break away from this sort of idea that one has to be more powerful than the other, and that's how that it works.
Have you read any Ursula Le Guin, any of her short stories?
Yeah, she's one of the people I was thinking of when I was talking about that. Her stuff is just so... She was just doing really great work and really exploring this idea that gender is only a constraint of our time. And I think it's really interesting.
And like, there's so many different ways that could express itself. And like, there's so many different ways that queerness could express itself beyond just like resisting homophobia. And like, resisting homophobia is the thing we all got to do. And like, that's a part of our lives. But we can decide whether or not it's a part of our fantasy worlds. And like, I really see the appeal in just being like, you know what? That's not here.
Yeah, it is. It is really fun because, you know, I mean, fantasy has such a long history, and whether people know it or not, we're always basing even our brand new stuff kind of on some of that history. And so for me, the key is to look at it really closely and say, what are the things that I'm bringing to this that I don't actually know that I'm bringing? The things that I've picked up along the way that I think are rules, but which aren't, which are actually just someone before me creating this thing. And so I really always want to look at that. What are the things that I'm making assumptions about that actually I don't have to keep, or that I don't have to bring with me, or that I could if I wanted to? For me, it's all about asking those questions and choosing.
Yeah, being very conscious that you are making that decision. I think that's true of like GMs and anyone coming to the table as much as it is. Yeah. Well, Shana, it's been so lovely talking with you. Is there anything else that you want to talk about?
I think what I'm working on right now that I'm really excited about is Predation, which is a setting about totally different than the other things I've done. I'm sure that will shock you because I seem to go all over the board, which is actually all about dinosaurs and far future technology. And right now I have dinosaurs in the brain, and that's been really fun. So I'm working on kind of three totally different projects at the same time, and that's actually the place where I thrive. I really like that.
Is Predation like connected with Numenera? Is it a different cipher system setting?
It is a different cipher system setting. We came out with a cipher system rule book last year, and so this is a setting that you can play using that book. And so it's totally different. Although I suppose, like, a lot of people have been asking if they could use it in their Strange game as a recursion, which would totally work too. But it's far future, like a couple hundred years in our future. Someone discovers time travel. This big interglobal corporation discovers time travel and sends a bunch of people back to the Cretaceous period, and then they get stuck there. And so the whole thing takes place in the Cretaceous period, but you have bioengineering, and you have all this high tech science, and you have weapons. And so what I really wanted to do was write about dinosaurs, but I didn't want to have to keep to the research. I wanted to make stuff up. And so this was my way of kind of creating a world with full of awesome dinosaurs where I could also have cool technologies and cool science. And so
that's super fun. So you're working on this at the same time that, I mean, you're working on the Numenera video game as well, right?
Yes, I'm working on that source book right now as well too.
How do you like mentally go from universe to universe, like from the Numenera to that to whatever else you're working on? Like, how do you transition?
So for me, it's about having each project in a different state. So like Predation right now is what I call in this sort of shower idea phase, where I have these sudden bursts of ideas at the very worst moments, and I'm like, oh my god, I gotta write that down. So Predation is very, very early, and it's all about, oh, look, there's a dinosaur thing, and just sort of this gathering of information that I know that I will want to put into the book. And then The Poison Eater, the novel, is kind of in the early stages of writing. And so when I immerse into that, I am thinking about the character. I enter through the character. It's told from the same narrator, the whole story. And so I actually have a playlist that's hers. And so I sometimes listen to that playlist before I start writing her so that I can kind of get her voice. And then for the Torment source book, I'm in the last stages of that. I'm kind of doing all the research details, putting it all together. So they're all very different parts of my brain. And for that, I actually use this program called Brain FM, the last one, where it's like it's just a weird set of sounds that helps you focus. And so Brain FM is when I start working on Torment, I turn that on. For The Poison Eater, I turn on this playlist of songs. And then for the Predation stuff, it's like, I don't know, anything can spark a match. I just have to like look at a picture and go, oh yeah, oh, there's this dinosaur.
So that project finds you.
Yeah, oh god, it like bowls me over. And at this point, the hard part is not sitting down and writing it. It's just, you know, wait, just gather the ideas, hold off. Because there's this thing where if I haven't started a project, it's perfect. But as soon as I start a project, of course, I've screwed it up. And so I always want to start the new thing because I'm like, oh, I'm going to get this one right from the beginning. It's going to be amazing. And I've done this long enough to know that that's not true.
But I like that you're still able to just like enjoy the honeymoon phase, like just appreciate it for what it is. That's nice.
That is totally what it is.
Well, Shana, if people want to keep up with these various extremely exciting projects, where can they find you?
I'm at shanagermain.com, and they can also always find me at montecookgames.com as well.
Awesome. And I know that you've mentioned that, you kind of got your start in writing through poetry and erotica. Will we see any new erotica from you in the near future?
You know, I hope so. It's a time thing, unfortunately. One of the things that's really important to me is I don't ever want to leave erotica behind, because I think that that keeps me honest, continuing to write it. Like, I feel like writing about sex and death are like the most honest places that a human being can have, right? You're making this choice of whether to expose yourself, whether to be truly you. And so as a writer, like, sex and death are kind of the places that I want, the wells that I want to go back to again and again. And so I hope that I don't leave erotica behind, because I want to continue to progress in that. But it's just a matter of time at this point, finding the time to really do that justice. But I hope so. I hope so. And there's actually quite a bit of sex in The Poison Eater. I feel like that I'm getting my a little bit of my erotica elements in there. Um, And so hopefully that'll satisfy me for a little while.
Nice. You can kind of get your fix through that. That's great. Well, yeah, those all sound super exciting and wonderful. So yeah, good luck with everything you got going on. It was really nice chatting with you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. That was amazing.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks to Shanna for coming on the show. And as always, thanks to you for listening. If you have thoughts on today's episode, I would love to hear them. You can send me an email to backstorypodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Google+, that's Backstory Podcast. Or you can tweet at me at BackstoryCast. If you're on iTunes, please consider giving the show a rating or a review. That's really the best way to help new people find the show. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can go to oneshotpodcast.com to find more great shows like One Shot, Campaign, Modifier, and Talking Tabletop. Our intro and outro music is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinking of You. If you like it, you can hear more at soundcloud.com/Ujiko. That's UJICO. Talk to you later, heroes.